Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Specialist in Internal Medicine, Stephanie Sorrell. Thank you, Stephanie. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much for joining us for this lunchtime webinar on feline urethral obstructions. So for an overview of today, we're going to discuss assessment of cases, stabilisation. We'll spend quite a bit of time on the management of electrolyte derangements, just because these can be quite profound and have implications on subsequent anaesthesia and sedation. Techniques for relieving the obstruction, further investigations to try and find the underlying cause, placement of an indwelling catheter, and then we'll go on to a protocol for financially limited patients and a case study. I've also chosen some key research papers as well, so that we can have as much evidence-based medicine for what we are proposing to do. So a little bit of background about these cases. So feline urethral obstructions occurs almost exclusively in male cats, and this is because of the narrower urethra in males compared to females, and it occurs equally in castrated males and neutered males. It occurs in a younger population of cats when compared to the typical referral population. So generally cats will be around about 1 to 7 years of age, and most cats will be younger than 4 when they have their first episode of obstruction. It is a potentially life-threatening emergency. It can lead to acute renal failure if untreated, and this is due to back pressure on the kidneys. It can also lead to ruptured bladder, but fortunately this is relatively rare. It can lead to some severe and profound electrolyte derangements we'll discuss in more detail, and it can also be a painful condition, and I think that's something that we definitely need to not overlook, because that's really important in the management of these cases. So the underlying etiology in most cases will be a urethral plug or urethral spasm. So urethral plug is just going to be an accumulation of like debris, cells and crystals within the urethra, and that can lead to a functional obstruction. You can also get a urethral spasm, so this is part of the feline idiopathic cystitis or feline interstitial cystitis, where there's no functional obstruction, but the cats have spasm of their urethra, which leads to a functional obstruction. Less commonly, there can be urolysts, just either one or multiple. There can be neoplasia, but thankfully that is rare, and there can also be strictures. And strictures are usually ones which are iatrogenic. So usually these are strictures which will occur secondary to traumatic urethral catheterization. And it should be remembered that when we place an urethral catheter, that can be a traumatic process. So we'll discuss ways to make this as simple as possible and causing as least irritation to the urethra, which is already going to be inflamed. In most cases, there will be a history of dysuria, stranguria, or polacuria, but it should be noted that some owners will present their cats as being constipated because they will think that they're struggling to defecate rather than struggling to urinate. In addition, some cats, we won't know about their urination history, particularly if they tend to urinate outside. So some owners will not be able to give you a full history, and we won't be able to pick this up until the physical examination. There can also be non-specific findings, so cats can present with inappetence, lethargy, some can even be obtunded or collapsed, and some can even vomit as well due to the electrolyte derangements. On physical examination, in most cases, there's a large, painful, turgid bladder that we can feel. Sometimes there can be a bradydysrhythmia, and that is due to the hyperkalemia or due to shock. So it should be remembered that cats which are presented in shock can have a low heart rate, normal heart rate, or a high heart rate. So initial assessment, it's absolutely vital that we do provide analgesia to these cases, and we will come on to discuss the best types of analgesia. Blood work to assess our renal parameters, electrolytes, and if possible, the acid-base status. The acid-base status is not essential to know, and most of these cats will present with a metabolic acidosis. But it is really essential that we have baseline renal parameters, because these cats will be presented with a post-renal azotemia, and there most likely is a pre-renal azotemia component as well. The severity of the azotemia does not indicate the prognosis or how well the cat is likely to do afterwards, so no decisions should be made on the severity of the azotemia. Electrolytes are absolutely essential that we measure, so particularly potassium. And if we have access to, it can also be very helpful to measure the ionized calcium as well. Fluid therapy is absolutely essential in all cases, and I think one of the main things that I want to get across in this webinar is that although we want to place a urethral catheter, that is not the primary aim of these cases. What we want to do is make sure they're stable, as firstly, and make sure that we provide enough fluid therapy, get the electrolytes under control, correct any fluid deficits before we think about placing a urethral catheter. The risk of bladder rupture is theoretical. There is a risk, but the risk is thankfully low. So all of these cases should be receiving intravenous fluid therapy even prior to having the urethra catheterized and unblocked. The metabolic derangements can be quite profound, and there is a study by Lee and Drobarts, which was published in 2003, where they reviewed the medical records of 223 cats with urethral obstruction. What they found in this case were that the majority of cats, so 76% of cats, were relatively stable, with 76% having a potassium concentration of less than 6 millimoles per litre. But that did leave us with 24% of cats which had electrolyte derangements. 12% of the cats had a severe hyperkalemia, so this is more than 8 millimoles per litre. And we'll come on to the causes of and effects of the high potassium. Hyperkalemia, though, did not occur in isolation, and the majority of these cats had a concurrent acidemia and low ionized calcium concentrations. And what we will come on to in a moment is that cats with severe hyperkalemia, one of the first treatments that we can consider is giving them calcium gluconate. So even if we cannot measure the ionized calcium, the majority of the cats with severe hyperkalemia will have a concurrent ionized hypocalcemia, and that can be treated with calcium gluconate as a twofold treatment. Of the animals with potassium concentration greater than 8 millimoles per litre, 75% had an ionized calcium concentration of less than 1 millimole per litre. And at less than 1 millimole per litre, we would definitely be thinking about supplementing calcium because that is going to have profound effects on our muscles. 79% of cats with a potassium concentration greater than 8 millimoles per litre had a blood pH less than 7.2. So these cats were severely acidemic. The good news from this study and from other studies as well is that the prognosis can be pretty good. So 93.6% of these cats did survive to discharge from the hospital, which is excellent. But one of the things that we do know is that recurrence rates can be high, and they've been cited at about 24% within 6 months. So we'll come on to our case study about a bit of the longer term management to try and reduce the risk of reoccurrence. So stabilization is going to vary according to each case and how severely affected they are. So some cases can present collapsed and obtunded, and in this instance, we will need to provide oxygen supplemented via a mask. An IV catheter should be placed in a cephalic vein in all cases so that they can have intravenous fluid therapy provided. Blood should be taken for an emergency database, so an ISTAT is ideal. An ISTAT will give us our hematocrit, ionized calcium, electrolytes, urea, and creatinine, so all of the essentials, and also a PCV and total solids should be performed. Ideally, we'd also have a full hematology and biochemistry as well, and these will provide all of our baseline data. Analgesia should be given. As I said, this is a painful condition, so this is really essential that we have that. And thinking of analgesia, we've got two different types that we can consider in two different main groups. So non-steroidals or opioids. And there has been a study which has looked at non-steroidals. So they looked at giving meloxicam in combination with buprenorphine to cats with urethral obstruction, or they gave just buprenorphine and a placebo. And what they found that cats with urethral obstruction, administration of non-steroidals did not influence the rate of recovery or the recurrence rate. It should also be noted that non-steroidals are contraindicated in hypovolemic shock. And a lot of these cases will present at least with some dehydration. So non-steroidals should not be the first line of treatment, but they could be considered in the post phase when animals are going home, when they have any degree of idiopathic cystitis, or if they have any spasm, the meloxicam can be helpful in these scenarios when we have addressed our fluid deficits. In opioid, we've either got buprenorphine or methadone, so things that are either a mu agonist, so like methadone, or a partial agonist, buprenorphine, and both of them will work really well. Buprenorphine has the added advantage of being able to be given sublingually, and it can also be administered at home by the owners. Fluid therapy is absolutely essential, but what we need to think about is what type we're going to give and what rate we're going to give. So the main things that we have is crystalloids. So we can either think about giving 0.9% sodium chloride, or we can think about giving Hartmann's. So historically, 0.9% sodium chloride was thought to be superior to correct the hyperkalemia, and that is because Hartmann's does have a small amount of potassium with it. However, there has been a study that was done in 2008 by Cole and Drobarts, and they showed that there was no significant difference in the rate of potassium normalization in cats that were given 0.9% sodium chloride or cats that were given Hartmann's, and these are all cats with urethral obstructions. What they did find, though, was that the acid-base status was corrected more rapidly in the patients receiving Hartmann's. So therefore, on the basis of this, the ideal fluid to give is actually Hartmann's. So with Hartmann's, it does have some potassium, but the main overriding effect will be the dilutional effect of the fluids. So that will reduce our potassium, and it will also correct the acid-base status because it's got buffers and bicarbonate in it. Having said that, if your only option is sodium chloride, then I'd still give sodium chloride. The rate will depend, and we will come on to try and work out how we're going to work out our fluid deficits. But in some cases, we will need to give boluses of fluids, and boluses are going to be required in the place in the cats which have hypovolemic shock. So calculating replacement fluid rates is what we need to do for all of these cases once we've addressed the shock. So we need to think about what the existing fluid deficit is, what the maintenance needs of our patients are, and what the ongoing losses are. And the ongoing losses in most cases is going to be negligible, but some cats will present with vomiting, so we might need to factor that in, but in all honesty, it might only be a few mils that they're vomiting up, so that's not really going to make that difference to the global replacement fluid rates that we are going to be addressing. So the first thing that we need to know is be able to estimate the degree of dehydration. So what we do know is that if an animal is less than 5% dehydrated, there's no detectable clinical signs. By 5 to 6% dehydration, there's a subtle loss of skin elasticity. By 6 to 8%, there's a definite delay in return of the skin to normal position, a slight prolongation of the CRT, eyes are possibly sunken, and dry mucous membranes. By 10 to 12% dehydration, tented skin stands in place, there's a prolongation of CRT, eyes are sunken, and dry mucous membranes. And by 12 to 15%, there's definite signs of shock. So when estimating the degree, it is, as it says, purely an estimate. So we need to give our best guess really to try and do that. So to work out the total fluid deficit, we need to know the body weight of our patient in kilograms, the percentage dehydration, and then we multiply that by 10. The maintenance requirements is going to be the body weight times our maintenance requirements per 24 hours. And our maintenance requirements are going to be 40 to 60 mils per kilo per day. So we average that at 50 mils per kilo per day. And any ongoing losses, if there's any vomiting or diarrhea, which in most cases this isn't going to be anything that's too significant. So what I do want to spend a little bit of time on is hyperkalemia. So potassium is a major intracellular cation, and it is really important involving in cellular function and neuromuscular transmission. And hyperkalemia can have profound cardiac effects with characteristic ECG changes that include bradycardia as a main sign. So with hyperkalemia, it causes a progressive depression in the cardiac excitability and the conduction velocity. And ECG changes do occur, which can be relatively classic. So what we can see on this slide, if I just show you with the arrow, is this is a normal resting potential. So the normal resting potential is going to be 90 millivolts. So that will be the normal for us. When we have a high potassium, though, the resting potential becomes less negative. So the resting potential is closer to the normal threshold. And initially, this causes the cells to be hyperexcitable, but it will affect the repolarization of cells. So over time, it leads to depolarization being more difficult and repolarization not occurring. And as such, it can lead to profound ECG changes. So we can have narrowing or tenting of the T waves, shortening of the QT interval, prolongation of the PR interval, and widening of the QRS complex. We can also get a decrease in the amplitude and widening of the P wave. Once we get more severe hyperkalemia, we get even more changes seen. So we can get a decrease in the amplitude and widening of the P wave. Atrial conduction can cease, so the P waves can completely disappear and we're left with atrial standstill. The QRS complex can merge with the T wave, creating a sine wave appearance. And in the severe cases, ventricular fibrillation or asystole can occur. So fluid therapy is going to be our absolute mainstay of treatment to reduce the potassium concentration. So just by the dilutional effect of giving 0.9% sodium chloride or Hartmann's, but additional medication might be needed in some cases. As we said from that paper that was done by Lee and Al in 2003, 76% of the cats which are going to present are going to have a potassium less than 6. So in most cases, fluid therapy is going to be sufficient. But we are going to have that subset, particularly for the cats with a potassium more than 8, but in reality, any of them more than 6, which are going to potentially need to have additional medication. So calcium gluconate is something that we can give. It is cardioprotective, but it does not reduce the potassium levels. So hyperkalemia makes the resting potential less negative, and the calcium will affect the threshold potential. So calcium makes the threshold potential less negative. And what calcium gluconate does is it restores the difference between the resting and threshold potentials by increasing the myocardial membrane threshold potential and restoring the normal membrane excitability. So if we go back to this drawing, we can see that the resting potential is less negative. So this is with the high potassium. The normal threshold is then less negative. So if we had calcium, a line would be here, and it restores the difference between the resting potential and the normal threshold, and therefore allows normal repolarization and depolarization to occur. And this is a first line for being cardioprotective. It's also really great having calcium gluconate because we know that most cats with a severe hyperkalemia will also have a concurrent ionized hypocalcemia, so it will be a twofold treatment. So just to be a bit more practical as well, I have given you some doses of what to give. The calcium gluconate is given at a dose of 0.5 to 1.5 mils per kilo of a 10% solution over 10 minutes. ECG monitoring should be done throughout, and if there is any prolongation of the QT interval or if there's worsening of the bradycardia, then the calcium should be stopped. The bolus can also be repeated if needed, and it lasts for about 20 to 30 minutes. So in some cases, it can buy us enough time just to place a urethral catheter. Other ways that we can try and reduce the potassium is by giving glucose. So glucose is working just by increasing endogenous insulin release, and insulin works by moving potassium into the cells from the extracellular fluid. Its effects will begin within about 20 minutes and last a few hours. We can go one step further and give insulin, which we'll also discuss, but just for giving glucose, we can give a 0.5 gram per kilo bolus over 10 minutes, and this equates to 2 mils per kilo of a 25% glucose solution. And we can make up a 25% glucose solution by diluting 50% dextrose in an equal volume of saline. So usually for a 5 kilo cat, you need about 10 mils of the 25% glucose solution. So you'd make 5 mils of the 50% dextrose and 5 mils of saline, and that would give us our 25% glucose solution. After giving a bolus of glucose, it's then advisable to give a CRI of glucose, and we usually start at a 2.5% CRI. And this is made up by removing 25 mils of saline from a 500 ml bag and adding 25 mils of 50% glucose, and that wakes up our 2.5% CRI of glucose. As I said, we can go one step further, and instead of just giving glucose, we can give insulin as well. So we can give exogenous insulin. What's absolutely essential in this case is that we always give glucose because otherwise severe hypoglycemia can occur. In addition, the glucose levels must be monitored for the next 24 hours. So we just give regular insulin, so the other name just being soluble insulin or neutral insulin, is given at a relatively conservative dose, so 0.25 to 0.5 international units per kilo. And if we gave that to a diabetic patient, we'd be repeating that dose every hour or two. But in a non-diabetic patient, the insulin has a much longer effect and can lead to hypoglycemia even up to 24 hours after this single bolus is given. So it's absolutely essential that once we give our regular insulin, we then follow it with a bolus of glucose and then a 2.5% glucose CRI. We measure our glucose regularly and we can up the CRI to 5% or give additional boluses if needed. In most cases, though, it's absolutely fine just to give the bolus and then a CRI and they are okay, but we need to monitor the glucose every 1 to 2 hours. Sodium bicarbonate is rarely used, and if it is used, we need to monitor the acid-base status of the patient, and we also need to monitor the calcium levels as well. It works with an IV dose of 1 to 2 milliequivalents per kilo and works by translocating potassium intracellularly. So the potassium ions will move into the cells as the hydrogen ions leave to titrate the administered bicarbonate in the extracellular fluid. It is really important that we are able to assess the acid-base status and the calcium because it can result in a paradoxical cerebral acidosis and it can also lead to hypocalcemia. And as we said, that most of the cases which have a high potassium will present with a concurrent acidemia and low ionized calcium. So given a drug which can lower the calcium can be quite severe. So if you are going to use sodium bicarbonate, it's absolutely essential that we give calcium gluconate first. So once we've dealt with the metabolic derangements, we can then think about relieving the obstruction. And with this, we've got two choices. We can either sedate our patient or we can have general anaesthesia. And for me, I prefer to have our patient fully anaesthetized so that the urethra is fully relaxed. Ideally, we want to have an open-ended catheter such as a slippery SAM, and that's because if there's any debris or potential stone or anything, it's easier to create pressure within the urethra to flush it into the bladder if we've got open-ended catheters rather than a side holes. So the standard Tomcat catheters with side holes can be more difficult to use in these scenarios. An IV catheter, so removing the stylet, can be used when the obstruction is very distal. So if it's very distal, then just a simple blue or green catheter can be really helpful. So we'll just go through some of these pictures first. So I would clip and prep the perineum, make sure it's as clean as possible, and then I would do a rectal exam. And the rectal exam is to try and see if there's any urolysis or potential neoplasia. I have to say, in the vast majority of cases, a rectal exam will be completely unremarkable, but it's always essential that it is performed. We then want to extrude the penis and examine it. So in a lot of cases, it will be signs of inflammation or the cats will have licked their penis, so there might be some erythema as well. The urinary catheter then is measured to L6 and is lubricated with sterile lubricant and inserted. Once the catheter is at the base of the penis is released and the prepuce is pulled caudally and dorsally to straighten the urethra and assist with advancing the catheter. The bladder is then flushed with sterile saline to remove any sediment. And what we want to do is when we're passing the catheter, we want to flush sterile saline into the bladder so that we're never pushing against any obstruction. Instead, we're just flushing it through. So if we just go over that again, to place the catheter, we want to clip and prep the perineum, lubricate the urinary catheter. Once the catheter is inserted at the base of the penis is released and the prepuce is pulled caudally and dorsally to straighten the urethra. Do not push against any obstruction, and instead we want to flush the urethra with sterile saline. We've got two options. So if we've got something like a urethral plug or a urolith that's in the urethra that's very difficult to lodge, we can try and increase the pressure within the urethra. So this can be done by one of two ways. We can either compress the urethra per rectum, so as we're flushing sterile saline in, someone else will be doing a rectal, pressing down on the urethra to increase the pressure between the two areas and then release it, Or we can occlude the tip of the penis while we're flushing saline in just to create an increase in pressure. Once the obstruction has been relieved, the bladder is flushed with sterile saline. And in most cases, they can be quite bloody urine, and we want to completely flush until it's clear. We then need to think about doing investigations to see why the cat has presented obstructed. And this can be with ultrasound. So ultrasound's really good to look at the bladder, see if there's any urolith, see if there's inflammation, if there's lots of sediment, but it's not very good to look at the urethra. So looking at the urethra, we want to do survey radiographs. So that will allow us to look at the urethra and the bladder, but to actually look at the mucosal surfaces and see if there's things like a stricture or if there's any radiolucent stones, then we need to have a retrograde urethrocystogram. So this is an example of a retrograde urethrocystogram, and in here we can see that the urethra is filled nicely. So all along here, it's all filling nicely through here. So this is a normal study. In the bladder, we can see that the contrast has filled as well, and this is all considered to be normal. What can be helpful in some of these cases is actually to perform an enema first. So you can see here that there's some feces within the colon. So in this one, it hasn't actually masked any of the highlighted urethra, but sometimes the feces in the colon or gas within the colon can make it more difficult to assess. So an indwelling catheter isn't required in all cases, and we must remember that when we are actually placing a catheter, that in itself is going to lead to some irritation within the urethra. So an indwelling catheter is necessary in patients where there's a severe azotemia because often that results in a post-obstructive diuresis, and that will mean that we want to measure our urine production to guide our fluid therapy. So we want to measure our ins or outs. If we've had a difficulty in relieving the obstruction, or there's a lot of sediment, or there's a lot of grossly abnormal urine or cystic calculi, then we'll want to also place an indwelling catheter to reduce the risk for immediate recurrent obstruction. If there's severe bladder distension, then that can lead to detrusor atony and inability to void the urine. And in these cases, we want a catheter so that we can keep the bladder as small as possible and allow the tight junctions to reform and to repair. So for the indwelling catheter, we want to think about having an atraumatic and soft catheter. It needs to be with sufficient length to actually reach the bladder, so ideally something like a Slippery Slam or a Miele EasyGo. So the Mieles are my favourite. They're really easy to use. They're 25 centimetres, so they're more than long enough to go into the bladder. They can, though, be quite soft, which is great for the cat because they're not going to be as traumatic, but they can sometimes be a bit difficult to place. So what I usually do is place them in the freezer beforehand because it just makes them a little bit more rigid. And then once they go to room temperature within the cat's environment, within the urethra, they're nice and soft again. We've got two main choices for the catheters. We can either think about placing a 3.5 French catheter, or we can place a 5 French catheter. And I'll come on to discuss which one's better based on some research. We always want to have a closed urinary system, and that can either be a commercially available closed urinary system, or you can make one with a fluid bag and a fluid line. And what's always important is that a urinary bag needs to be placed below the cat to allow gravity to bring the urine into the bag, but also to prevent any retrograde flow of urine from the bag into the cat again. We want to have a closed urinary system so we can monitor our ins and outs, but we also want a closed urinary system to reduce the risk of infection. And in all cases, we should have a buster collar placed so that the cats don't self-remove. The sample should be submitted for full urinalysis, and it's really important to note that most cases will have hematuria, definitely macroscopic in a lot of cases, but in all cases they will have microscopic. Struvite crystals can also be present, so particularly if the urine has been sitting there for a while within the bladder. Just because there are crystals there doesn't equate to stones, but we do need to be thinking about doing X-rays or retrograde urethrocystograms or ultrasound to try and see if there are any urolith. We'll come on to a paper looking at UTIs as well, but what can be said about UTIs is that urinary tract infections are very uncommon at presentation. So if there are financial limitations, it is absolutely fine just to do a urine sediment examination and dipstick because most cases will not have a UTI at presentation. However, a UTI is more likely to occur if we have got an indwelling catheter. So ideally, we'd want to do daily sediment examinations because there's a risk of a UTI with an indwelling catheter. So antibiotics are not indicated unless we've got a UTI which has been confirmed on the basis of culture and sensitivity. So there was a prospective study done in 2013, and this looked at cats with urethral obstruction and found that there were 0% of positive cultures on presentation, but 33% of positive cultures post-catheterization. So in these cases, it's really important that we think about submitting urine for culture when removing the catheter, particularly if there's evidence of it on sediment examination. Decompressive cystocentesis is something that has been controversial because it has been thought that it could potentially lead to bladder rupture. It's really performed if urinary catheterization is unsuccessful or if it's unsafe to proceed with anaesthesia, so if you've got a severe hyperkalemia that we just can't control. What is advised to use is a 23-gauge butterfly needle and drain as much of the urine as possible. There was a study that was done in 2015 looking at 47 cats with urethral obstruction, and they all had a decompressive cystocentesis followed by placement of an indwelling urinary catheter. What they found in this study is that there weren't any signs of bladder rupture, which was really good, but 19 of 34 cats that had survey x-rays did have loss of peritoneal detail consistent with abdominal effusion. So from this study, they can have a low-grade uroabdomen following a decompressive cystocentesis, but it all resolved on its own, and none of the cats did have any evidence of bladder rupture. So from this study, it does seem safe to perform a decompressive cystocentesis. I have to say, though, that in most cases, I don't perform one because I do find that it doesn't take that long to usually stabilise our cases so that they're ready for anaesthesia. Post-obstructive diuresis can be really profound, so it's defined as anything with a urine output more than 2 mL per kilo per hour. And what has been shown is that cats that are obstructed for longer than 48 hours or cats that are severely azotemic can experience a significant post-obstructive diuresis. And in a study that was done in 2010, a post-obstructive diuresis was documented in 46% of cats within 6 hours after relief of obstruction. And the cats at greatest risk were those which were acidemic, and in there they defined it as a venous pH of less than 7.35. Several cats, though, did have diuresis up to 84 hours following relief of their obstruction, so it is really important that we think about monitoring our ins and outs and providing enough fluid therapy as well for quite a prolonged period. It's really important that we monitor electrolytes every 4 to 6 hours because initially we're worried about a hyperkalemia, although over time we can risk getting a hypokalemia. I'd only measure the renal parameters every 24 hours because we're not expecting these to rapidly change. Urethral spasm is a common cause for urethral obstruction, but it's also a common cause for subsequent reobstruction as well. And I think it's important to realise that the pre-prostatic and the post-prostatic and penile portion of the urethra are controlled by different muscles. So the proximal pre-prostatic portion of the feline urethra is primarily controlled by smooth muscle, whereas the distal post-prostatic and penile portion is primarily controlled by striated muscle. So for medications, we can think about alpha-1 antagonists, so things like prazosine or phenoxybenzamine. So it's prazosine is a smooth muscle relaxant, which can be given at 0.5 mg per cat either 2 to 3 times a day, increasing up to 1 mg per cat. Because it is a smooth muscle relaxant, it can also lead to hypotension, so the blood pressure should be measured. So the skeletal muscle relaxant for the post-prostatic and penile portion of the urethra, we'd use dantrolene, and that's given at 0.5 mg BID, and that can be increased up to 2 mg BID. Bethanacol I put a question mark on because most cases aren't going to need this, but it can be given where we've had prolonged distension in the bladder that can induce detrusor atony by causing separation of the tight junctions of the detrusor muscle, and that then results in very weak and ineffective muscle contractions. And patients with detrusor atony are going to require more prolonged urethral catheterization, so in some cases 7 days or even longer, because you want to keep the bladder as small as possible so we can re-establish tight junction connections. If we are going to give bethanacol, it's got quite a wide dose range, so it's 0.625 mg to 5 mg per cat 3 times a day. The risk of recurrence is high, so it's up to about 24% within 6 months. What has been shown is prazosin does have a reduced risk of reobstruction at both 24 hours and 30 days when compared with phenoxybenzamine. So cats that were given prazosin, 7.14% of them reobstructed at 24 hours compared to 21.74% that were given phenoxybenzamine. And at 30 days, 18.18% of cats reobstructed with prazosin, whereas 39.02% reobstructed with phenoxybenzamine. A smaller urethral catheter, so a 3.5 French rather than a 5 French, may be associated with a decreased risk of reobstruction within 24 hours. So cats which had a 3.5 French, 6.67% of those reobstructed at 24 hours versus 18.97% which had a 5 French catheter. So based on this, I'd always place the smallest catheter possible to try and reduce the risk of urethral inflammation. It's also important to think about increasing water intake and environmental modification. So our multimodal environmental modification, so things like Feliway and other things which we'll come on to talk about briefly. So what I did want to spend a little bit of time on is looking at the protocol, which was published in 2010 for managing urethral obstruction in male cats without urethral catheterization. So this is definitely not the gold standard, but it is something that can be considered if owners are very financially limited, because placing a catheter, having them in a hospital is expensive, and we also know that this is a recurrent disease. So this is a condition that can keep going on and can be very expensive to treat. What we do know is that the cause of urethral obstruction is idiopathic in more than 50% of cases. So in these are cats which have feline idiopathic or interstitial cystitis, and what we do know is that stress plays a key role in this. Urolithiasis can occur in about 29% of cases, and urethral plugs can occur in about 18% of cases. So what this study wanted to do was exclude all of the cats with stones, but look more closely at the cats which had idiopathic reasons, so things like urethral spasm and also urethral plugs, to try and see whether we could manage these cats without catheterization. And what the authors speculated was that pharmacological manipulation of stress, urethral tone, and discomfort could alleviate some of the functional component of the obstructive process and might then preclude the need for catheterization. If this treatment was successful, then it could be one which is reduced cost as well as reduced complications. So placing a urethral catheter is not a benign process. We can exacerbate urethral inflammation that's already there. We can potentially cause urethral trauma, which can lead to strictures, and we can also then cause urinary tract infections. And what they did in this study is they charged the owners a standard flat fee of £350, which was much reduced compared to their previous £1,200 if they had a full-on urethral catheter and proper stay. So for this, I think it's important to look at their inclusion criteria. So these ones were diagnosed with urethral obstruction, and the owners were considering euthanasia due to the finances. So they tried to exclude the really severely affected cats. So these are ones where the heart rate was less than 120 beats per minute, the rectal temperature was less than 35.6 degrees C, any cats with unresponsive mentation, where the venous pH was less than 7.1 or the serum potassium was more than 8, or if there was any radiographic evidence of cystic or urethral calculi, because those ones need to have hydropulsion and then think about doing surgery. They didn't use the severity of acidemia at the time of initial examination as an inclusion or exclusion criterion. And that is because we know that cats can be really severely azotemic, but it doesn't affect their prognosis. Cats were given ACP, so acepromazine, at 0.25 mg IM, and they were given buprenorphine at 0.075 mg IM to provide sedation and analgesia and help to minimize their stress. 10 minutes later, the penis was extruded, inspected, and massaged in an attempt to dislodge any obstructions in the distal portion of the penis. They made one single attempt to gently express the bladder, and if no urine was produced, then they did decompress the cystocentesis. So in this study, they had a 22-gauge, 1.5-inch needle connected to extension tubing, three-way stopcock, and a 20-mil syringe. And in this case, the cystocentesis was there to alleviate the bladder distension and discomfort. They took a lateral abdominal radiograph after initial administration of the ACP and the buprenorphine and the initial cystocentesis. And with this one, they ruled out any cystic or urethral calculi. So none of these cats had any evidence of calculi, but 7 of the 15 did have evidence of a mineralized material, which is presumed to be a plug, which we'll come on to on the next slide. So on here, you can see the arrows, which I'll draw as well. So here we've got this mineralized material. So this is thought to be the urethral plug, and there's also mineralized material within the bladder as well. So it's also in this study, they actually placed no intravenous catheters. So none of these cats received any intravenous fluid therapy. And they received 0.9% sodium chloride sub-Q at 100 to 200 mils, and that was at the discretion of the clinician. Cats were then placed in a low-stress environment consisting of a darkened, low-traffic treatment ward that did not house any dogs. So with this, they're mainly being treated for their feline idiopathic cystitis and urethral spasm. The general status and presence of spontaneous urination were assessed every 8 hours, and additional doses of ACP and buprenorphine were administered every 8 hours. Cystocentesis was performed as needed, up to 3 times a day. A medetomidine, so 0.1 mg IM every 24 hours, was administered starting 24 hours after the initial examination, and that was to provide more sedation and also urethral relaxation. Additional fluids were given at the attending clinician's discretion, and again, this was only subcutaneously because none of these cats had IV fluids or IV catheters placed. So if we look at this again, the treatment included ACP, which was given IM or per os, buprenorphine, which was given IM or per os, medetomidine, which was given starting 24 hours after the initial, decompressive cystocentesis as needed, up to 3 times a day, sub-Q administration of fluids as needed, so 100 to 200 mils per day, and a dark, quiet room. So no intravenous catheters were placed and no urethral catheters were placed. And the treatment was defined as being successful if there was spontaneous urination within 72 hours and subsequent discharge from the hospital. So after discharge, the cats were given ACP, so acepromazine 2.5 mg per os every 8 hours and buprenorphine 0.075 mg sublingually every 8 hours. And they were given 5 days after discharge. The owners were also given instructions on increasing water intake, the appropriate number of litter trays, and implementation of environmental enrichment. So with these ones, they were all told to have an extra litter box for each cat. So if there was 2 cats in the household, they'd need to have 3 litter boxes. So 9 of the 11 cats urinated spontaneously within 48 hours after treatment was initiated. The mean number of cystocentesis was performed as 3, but there was a wide range from 1 up to 10, and the mean duration of hospitalisation was 67 hours. The treatment was successful in 11 of the cats. In the remaining 4, it failed because 3 of them developed a uroabdomen and 1 developed a hemoabdomen. Necropsy was performed on 3 cats in which treatment had failed, and all 3 had severe inflammatory disease of the urinary bladder, but none had evidence of bladder rupture. So it may be that this was similar to the previous study we looked at, where they can have evidence of abdominal effusion, and it can be due to leakage from the cystocentesis site, but it might be self-limiting if there's no bladder rupture, and they might reabsorb that fluid afterwards. What they did find, though, was that there was no recurrence of urethral obstruction by 3 days after discharge. 2 out of 11 of the cats did have a recurrence by 3 weeks after discharge, but they were successfully treated with the same protocol. And 0 out of 7 had recurrence within a year. So actually looking at recurrence rates with this protocol, it does seem to be relatively successful. So it is a low-cost protocol, definitely an alternative to euthanasia, and there's no increase in recurrence rates. So it is something that we can consider if owners are going to otherwise consider euthanasia. This is a low-cost protocol that we could look at. But it's absolutely essential that we choose the cases appropriately and don't have any cats which have urolysts. So I just wanted to end this talk with looking at a case study. So this was Mr. T, who's a 3-year-old male neutered indoor-only domestic short hair. He had a 24 history of stranguria with no urine seen over the past 12 hours. He was inappetent and vomiting on the morning of presentation. So on physical examination, he was obtunded. He had an enlarged, tense and painful bladder, a heart rate of 120, so he was bradycardic with weak synchronous pulses. His rest rate was increased at 40 with normal effort. He was hypothermic at 36.9. His mucous membranes were pale with a CRT of 3 seconds. So all of this pointed towards an urethral obstruction. The physical examination also raised concerns that he might have hypovolemic shock given the bradycardia and the poor pulses, but the bradycardia may also be indicative of a hyperkalemia and electrolyte derangements. So if we look at the blood work so we can see that he's azotemic, so 40 and of the urea and 380 of the creatinine. He's severely hyperkalemic of 8.5, so that can definitely explain our bradycardia, at least in part. His ionized calcium is less than 1, so again, this is like the previous study where it goes hand in hand with the high potassium, and his hematocrit and total proteins were within normal limits. So what we need to think about now is what rate of fluids we're going to give. So because he's got evidence of hypovolemic shock, I would give a bolus. So I'm always a bit more cautious in cats compared with dogs, just because we don't want to have any fluid overload. So in this case of Mr. T, I gave him a 10 ml per kilo bolus of Hartmann's over 15 minutes and monitored the response. So his pulse quality had improved, but it had not normalised. So repeated the bolus of another 10 ml per kilo, and his pulse quality and blood pressure at this stage normalised. We then need to think about calculating our replacement fluid rates. So Mr. T is a standard domestic short hair and he weighed 5 kilos. So with total deficit, so we estimated him to be 7% dehydrated once we'd resolved the hypovolemic shock. So we need to think about his body weight, times that by the percent dehydration and times it by 10. So in this scenario, it's going to be 5 kilos times by 7% dehydration times by 10, and that's 350 mils. We then need to think about our maintenance requirements. So he's 5 kilos, so that's 5 times 50, which is 250 mils. He did have some vomiting, but that's going to be one which was just a single episode of a few mils. So personally, I wouldn't include that in the fluid measuring requirements. So our fluid requirement over 24 hours will be 600 mils. So he'll need to have a rate of 5 mils per kilo per hour of Hartmann's over 24 hours to correct his fluid deficit. So we continued his fluids at 5 mils per kilo per hour, repeated electrolyte measurements, and the potassium was still elevated. So it had reduced from 8.5 to 7.2, but just fluids on their own were not enough in this scenario. So on here we can see his ECG, which is a really nice classic one. If we look at lead 2 here, we can see that there's absolutely no P waves. So everywhere there's just flat line here, and this is atrial standstill. And he's got really peaking tall T waves and a widened QRS. So this is classic of atrial standstill due to the hyperkalemia. So Mr. T had a bolus of calcium gluconate, so that will help twofold because he did have an ionized hypocalcemia, and it will also help to be cardioprotective. So he had 1 ml per kilo of a 10% solution over 10 minutes, and he was also given insulin and glucose therapy due to the severity of the hyperkalemia. So he received 0.25 international units per kilo soluble insulin. He then had a 0.5 gram per kilo bolus of glucose and then a 2.5% glucose CRI, and the potassium normalised to 5 millimoles per litre. So general anaesthesia was then performed. He had urethral catheterisation and debris flushed into his bladder, and the bladder was flushed until the urine ran clear. We placed an indwelling catheter and also put on a Buster collar. So he had a retrograde urethrocystogram, and this is the same one that we've seen previously. So in this case, Mr. T was completely normal, so urethra filled nicely. So we can see here, so it's good filling all the way along the urethra and with the bladder with no evidence of cystic or urethral calculi. So with this, he was suspected to have a urethral plug with spasm, so feline idiopathic cystitis. So on urinalysis, he did have hematuria. On dipstick, his pH was 8 with 4 plus blood and 4 plus protein. Sediment examination reveals struvite crystalluria, which can be quite common in these cases, and culture was negative. As we said, culture doesn't really need to be done in a lot of these cases because the vast majority are going to have negative culture at first presentation. So we gave him some prazosine. This is a smooth muscle relaxant at 0.5 mg per kg BID and monitored his blood pressure. He had dantrolene, which is a skeletal muscle relaxant at 0.5 mg twice a day. And he also had buprenorphine for the pain, so 0.02 mg per kg 4 times daily. So blood work after 24 hours, we can see that the azotemia started to improve, but he was now hypokalemic, and that's with all the high rates of fluid therapy. So he was receiving 5 mL per kilo per hour of Hartmann's. So with these ones, he then needs to have some potassium added into his fluids. We can see that the ionized calcium is now normalized after the calcium gluconate bolus, and the hematocrit and total protein has stayed within normal limits. So his IV fluids were reduced to 3 mL per kilo per hour, and he started to be supplemented with potassium chloride. And in this, we monitored his ins and outs, and they matched. So with him, he probably did have a post-obstructive diuresis, but we started him on quite a high rate of fluids at 5 mL per kilo per hour, and then reduced to 3 mL per kilo per hour. We continued his antispasmodics and the analgesia. And as we can see, by 48 hours, he was non-azotemic, the potassium was normal, the ionized calcium was normal, and the hematocrit and total protein remained within normal range. So the azotemia resolved, and his antispasmodics and analgesia were continued. The IV fluids were reduced to 2 mL per kilo per hour and then stopped. And the urinary catheter was removed, and we cultured the urine on removal, which was negative. And we witnessed him having voluntary urination. So he was discharged after 4 days of hospitalization. The longer term management, and I think this is where it can be a bit more difficult because there's no true evidence base as to what to give. So prazosine and dantrolene, I did continue for 2 weeks before weaning him down. I did change him onto a wet diet. So increasing water intake by feeding a wet food is definitely recommended for these cases, but also having things like a water fountain or automatic water dispensers can also be helpful as well. Feliway diffusers are advised to place around the house, and this is because this is we know it is Feliway is a synthetic F3 fraction of the naturally occurring feline facial pheromone, and treatment with this pheromone has been reported to reduce the amount of anxiety experienced by cats in unfamiliar circumstances, and it also can reduce the number of clinical signs. But there have been lots of studies into this, and nothing has shown that it's been truly significant in cats with urethral obstruction. But providing Feliway diffusers is something which isn't going to cause any harm. So with him, luckily, we didn't have any reoccurrence, and he did go on to do very well. So to sum up, this is an acute life-threatening emergency, which can be very challenging but rewarding to treat. What I do want to say is that the normalization of the normalizing our severe electrolyte derangements does take precedent over urethral catheterization, and aggressive fluid resuscitation is absolutely essential for the best outcome. So it is really important that we think about this because once we anesthetize and sedate patients, we can lead to peripheral vasodilation and myocardial depression, and that's going to be re-accentuated if we've already got an existing fluid deficit. Most cats will survive to discharge, so from studies it's usually between 90% to 95%, but there is a risk of reoccurrence. So although this is an emergency procedure to think about placing the urethral catheter and emergency things that we need to do, it's also really important that we speak to owners about the longer term management and use things like multimodal environmental modification, so changing onto a wet food, increasing the water intake of the cats, providing things like Feliway as well, and potentially things like amitriptyline for refractory cases. So I hope that's summed it up nicely for everybody, and I'm happy to take any questions at this stage.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Stephanie for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.